Okay, well, thanks for having me. I have to admit, I'm relatively new to this industry, so this will be interesting. All right, so I want to figure out who's here. So if you are in the automotive industry, as in you work for an automaker or something in that domain, raise your hand. Let's see who's here. Okay, good. How about academics, your research in this area? Okay. Any students or just enthusiasts? And anyone who works directly on self-driving cars right now? All right, okay, so this will be a good group. So as Martin was saying, I think there's a lot of people wondering, like, you know, why would you get into this industry? How do you do it? Especially, you know, being, as I said, a newcomer to the industry. And so I want to talk a little bit about that because that kind of frames, you know, our strategy and the way we design this first product. So I'll start real quick. What we've built is called the Cruise RP1, and we're describing it as a highway autopilot. So this is more like a level 2 automation system. And the way it works is you drive onto a lane in the highway, the one you want to be in, and you just push a button and it takes over, kind of like cruise control. So it keeps you in the lane and does adaptive cruise control. And the difference between sort of what's already out there, I guess, is this system is completely hands-free, 0 to 80 miles an hour. So you can go, like, pretty much the entire highway segment of your trip is done by our system. So really cool. All right, so going back. So self-driving cars are really cool, and this is something I've wanted to do for, like, 15 years. When I was 13 years old, I won a state science fair with basically a small self-driving car. That was like a kiddie car that had a webcam on it and a Pentium 233 processor. And then 7 years later, at MIT, I worked on the very first year of the DARPA Grand Challenge. We had a Ford F-150 with a server rack in the back that had 10 dual-core servers and used, you know, kilowatts of power. And we never even made it off the starting line that year. So things have changed. Now, like, all that computational power fits into basically what's in your pocket right now on your cell phone, and sort of made applications like this, you know, something I think is, you know, the timing is right, is what I'm getting at here. So, you know, I spent the last 7 years working on another company called Twitch, which is like a web video startup, which has done really well, but basically learned the mechanics of building a business, especially a high-tech business. And going through that process. So I finally had a chance to start all over and say, like, okay, if I could do anything right now, what would I want to do? And I immediately jumped back to this industry and spent about a month poking around to see what the state of the art was, you know, what was Google doing, what are their challenges, what are they facing, what are all the car makers thinking, what's going to be next? And then I thought, okay, if I want to get in this space as a startup, how could you do it? I mean, these competitors are $100 billion companies or more. They have infinite resources and distribution channels and all these things that make entering that market very difficult. And so I played around with a bunch of different ideas, and you can ask Brad. I talked to him about some of these, including like valet parking or...
they were all branded except for them.
and the problem I came up with is when you're trying to start a business, especially a startup, you need to have revenue very soon. You can't just spin in R&D mode for 10 years and figure out the perfect solution. So things like valet parking were really interesting and seemed like something that people would want, but I couldn't find a way to make the cost of a system, especially a retrofit system, and the value you get from that, which is maybe parking when you go to a shopping mall or something, those just didn't line up. Like, no one's going to pay $10,000 to have your car park when you go to a restaurant. So I kept spinning on that for a while, and I looked at low-speed urban driving, which is ultimately the direction Google is going right now, which is really interesting, but I think that's an incredibly challenging problem, and even Google is still working on that one. And so I thought, that's probably not the good place for a startup to start, because I think we'd burn through all our money just trying to figure out how to do it and then have nothing to show for it. So then I looked at the highways, which are interesting because especially in California and several other states, there's restricted access highways where what that means is in most cases there's a physical barrier preventing pedestrians or bicyclists from entering the highway. There's no stoplights or traffic lights, and there's no driveways. So it's sort of, if you take the entire scope of the self-driving car universe and scrape it down to the simplest version of that, that's kind of what these restricted access highways are. So I thought that would be interesting because that's one of the most more technically straightforward problems to solve and has a lot of value to people. Like, you know, if you're in California, a third of the workforce here commutes over an hour a day. So that's a lot of time people spend behind the wheel, most of it on the highway, you know, stop and go traffic, long trips. And so I thought this is where we should focus our efforts. And so that's kind of how we go from, you know, outside this industry to arriving on this particular product. And then doing it as an aftermarket product, a retrofit, is kind of the only choice as a startup. If you build this cool technology, and I'm sure many of you would be capable of something like this, and say, I've got this thing, and walk into a car company, maybe Nissan, they might listen, but maybe others wouldn't, and say, I've got this great technology. And they say, okay, well, let's think about it. Let's integrate it. Maybe we've got like a 3 to 5 year product cycle. We'll try to fit you in like 2020. And again, that's kind of troublesome as a startup because you're going to be out of money by then. So that sort of makes aftermarket the necessity and ultimately, I think, a pretty good business if you consider there's 250 million cars on the road in the U.S. right now and only, I think, 14 million new cars made every year. So there's a huge market sitting there of this existing fleet of vehicles that are on the road. So that's exciting. That's the one we chose to attack. And about, 9 months ago now, I put together a small team, raised some money. We're still very small, I think 7 people now. And we set out to build this prototype, sort of like a proof of concept that this can be done by a small team in a form that is attractive to consumers, you know, fits this whole concept of product market fit. You know, we've got something. It is designed to sort of appeal to what people actually want, which in this case we believe is, you know, help with their daily commute and that grind, and at a price that's attractive to them. Our system is $10,000, which, granted, is not cheap, but you know, that's the starting point. The very first laptops and cell phones were in that realm, so I don't think that's something we're too worried about at this point. And then to get from sort of like idea to working prototype to launch and start taking pre-orders, we basically took as many. Well, we thought about how we could optimize that whole process. So in this case, that meant starting with like open source software and frameworks, using commodity hardware, a lot of 3D printing for prototyping, and to just like shorten the development cycles here and eliminate any distractions or anything that could get in the way. And we pulled that off. I saw Brad before I even started working on this at all, and then I think I came back to him 6 months later and said, it's done, do you want to go for a ride? And so I think that's sort of something interesting that startups bring to the table in this industry is like we may not have decades of sort of knowledge of how things should be done, but we have a fresh approach and we can move very, very quickly. And I think that's sort of the only advantage a startup or a small company has, against the existing players in this space. Cool. Okay. So I want to talk a little more at the end. We can just sort of like open up a dialogue here and see what you guys think about all this stuff. But I brought you some fun stuff. I don't have like a slideshow to run through here, but what I do have are some videos and pictures from early on in the dev process because I thought it might be fun to see behind the scenes. I know when I go to conferences and see Google presenting, my favorite part is always when they show, you know, screenshots of their software and you get to look at it and see what's going on, like how does it see the world. So I have a little bit of that too. They don't say anything else. Yeah. Let's see. I don't remember how these go. So this was like really early on, like first month. We like basically bought a copy of the steering column of this Audi S4, and we're playing around with different ways to sort of 3D print brackets that would bolt right on top of the existing steering column and actuate it. So this is not what we ended up going with, but this was one of our early prototypes. And then, of course, like you need a way to test your drive-by-wire system, so we use the PlayStation controller. So I actually spent a lot of time driving around San Francisco Grand Theft Auto style with the PlayStation controller. let's see what else we got. And so this is one of our early sensor pods. What's kind of unique about our system is all the sensors go in one unit that just bolts on. The idea there was to make it very easy to install. Two cameras, radar, GPS, and inertial sensors. And this is one of our tests we did, I think about maybe 3 months ago, and this is on Treasure Island. We just set up a little cone course, and the car is at this point driving autonomously using one of our new newer sensor pods.
So did you rent this, or you just went there?
This one we just kind of showed up. It looked pretty abandoned. So here's one of the fun things. So right now we're using our cameras mainly to do lane tracking, vehicle detection, and this is like just a quick screenshot of that running. It's pretty similar in performance at this point to what Mobileye has on their monocular camera system. We're not quite to parity with them yet, but we're close. That was 101.
Is the lane tracking looking for the white stripes?
Yeah.
So if the stripes disappear, or if you've got like 85 in map view where there's several sets of them all over the place?
I know that spot really well. so we thought about that, and our solution, again, is like we have this focus on getting to market as quickly as possible, so how can we simplify or constrain the problem? We basically don't solve it. So what we do instead is we geofence basically all the highways we support and say, like, you know, there are clear lane markers. We've collected enough data to be confident that there's not going to be a problem here. And every other area is also sort of tagged, and we initiate a handoff well before you get there to avoid that.
What is the percentage of coverage? I mean, I claim that 101 is like...
That's a good question. I haven't measured that yet. Yeah, so that's something where right now it's probably not very good, but over time I think we'll tighten it up a little bit. What the coverage is on 101 in terms of percentage that's...
In around the Bay Area, right?
Oh, yeah.
When you pay $10,000, how long can you drive?
Particularly from Martin's house.
Right.
Although I can think...
There's this parking lot on Treasure Island?
Yeah, it works there.
I'm
thinking my house to Tahoe. That's what I'm looking forward. Yeah. We don't do driving at night right now.
Does
yeah.
that auto turn on?
It doesn't turn on unless it's already getting good data. Okay. So the cameras are rolling like as soon as you get on the highway. It just won't let you push the button until it has good data coming in. Same thing. Like sort of as the quality degrades, we monitor that, how well we can see the lane markers. Yeah, initiates a handoff. Doesn't just shut off. Yeah.
Do you have a video of the handoff?
I don't. No. Well, I might. Well, I have one starting it in one of these TechCrunch videos here. I don't. So some of you have already. I'm sure already seen this video. So I'll just sort of play it in the background here. But this was an event we had not too long ago. Maybe a month ago. And this time we actually did rent the area. This is the Alameda airstrip. We had an event out there. We had two of our cars running, and there was about a half mile long track just with orange cones. And the cars were just basically doing loops at that point. And there was no driver intervention required. I think probably I sat in the car for over 100 loops on one of those days. And so you'll see in a second, we'll actually get behind the wheel here. And me talking. Okay. So in this case, to turn on the system, I'm just going to push the button if I haven't already done it. Who's driving? I'm driving. Okay, so that was it. I pushed the button, which is located down in the center console, and now the car's got control. And if I wanted to disable it, I would just tap the gas pedal or the brake pedal, and that's it. Just kind of like cruise control.
How do you adjust the speed?
Speed? I thought about that, and there's sort of a tricky issue, because if you're going to, you know, have a robot or a vehicle that has some automation built in, you think it should obey laws. But speed limit's a tricky one, because if you always follow the speed limit, you're going to have a lot of angry drivers around you. So what we did instead is we let the operator control that. So when you turn it on, it locks in at whatever speed you're going, and then you can just rotate the knob left or right to adjust your set speed. Yeah, so it kind of like adaptive cruise control. It slows down for traffic and then speeds up. You guys are good. Yeah. More questions.
Okay, yeah. So what do you do with the impedance? So if you tap gas or brakes, then driver takes control. What if you do that accidentally and you didn't really mean it and you're not really paying attention?
That's a good question. So there's audio cues to indicate when that's happened. I haven't thought through that. That's a good one. I'm going to write that down. If you accidentally tap the gas or brake and inadvertently disable the system. Yes. We're playing with that. It's a little strange if you're on the highway and you're trying to grab the wheel firmly to take control again. It's difficult the way we do things to sense the difference between maybe like hitting a bump in the road or a person grabbing on. And if you have that threshold set too high, then a person grabs the wheel and tries to like jerk it, and then you're on the highway going 80 miles an hour. You don't want to be jerking the steering wheel. So we haven't found a good sort of human interaction solution for that yet.
Hang on a second.
So you went through a lot of pain trying to make the actuators you were showing us outside for the brake pedal and the gas pedal and stuff.
Yeah.
But there are cars that are drive-by-wire now, right?
Yeah.
Like the Prius and other cars where wouldn't it have been a lot easier to sort of tap into something like that? Or is it a matter of finding people willing to pay $10,000 to adapt that to such a car?
That's a good question. I mean, my initial thought was this particular Audi does have electromechanical power steering. And so in theory, you could maybe spoof the signal from the torque sensor and try to get it to drive that way. But that becomes a safety issue really quickly. If you're sending signals down a CAN bus, especially sort of on the safety critical side of things, and you know maybe this power steering unit has a fault in it or it has some sensor fail, and I'm sending those signals in not knowing what's going on, that could be bad. So instead, we try to interact with the car as much as possible like a human would. So we physically turn the wheel, push the brake pedal to avoid any problems like that. And it's also modular. I don't need to install this on a drive-by-wire vehicle. It could be any vehicle. Yeah.
Is it a building camera-based system, or are you planning to add radar as well?
Add what?
Radar.
So it has two cameras and a radar right now. Yeah, and so in terms of sensor selection, we were basically trying to figure out what's the best quality data we can get that fits into our price point, and that's what we ended up with. So, for example, if some new company comes out with a really inexpensive high-performance LiDAR, I guarantee that's going to go in there.
How do your strap-on actuators affect the feel of the vehicle for a person driving manual?
So the brake pedal, you don't feel it at all the way it's designed mechanically. Like, you can apply pressure or the system can, and there's no feedback there. On the steering wheel, right now, you're back-driving the motor, and so you feel it a little bit. We're going to address that before we go to market with this, though.
Yeah. Do you calibrate the cameras online?
Not yet. We definitely need to. So yeah, I should back up a little bit. So this thing is not on the market yet, and that's for good reason. We have a lot of sort of open questions and things we're still working through. I have confidence we'll get through them hopefully soon.
So are you shooting for level 2 autonomy at this point?
Level 2. Yeah.
And have you looked into the human machine interaction issues, the human factors, how to keep the driver still engaged and comfortable and being able to take over when you need to?
Yeah, that like despite the fact that we're a startup in this industry with $100 billion companies and have to raise money on marketing and sales and all this, the scariest thing for me is what you just described.
Exactly.
So dealing with that.
That's for level 2, level 3. That's a very big issue.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's still an open question for us. We've tried a lot of things. We're going to try a lot more.
You said you're going to geofence areas that are not capable of the autonomous driving. Mm-hmm. How are you going to update those areas? Do you have a wireless communication also built into this?
Yeah, so it's got 4G connectivity. So the idea is there we can sort of update cached data, whatever stored locally, maps, or in this case, sort of these geofenced areas.
Do you look at cars approaching you? What's your field of vision?
It's enough. It's a little over 90 degrees, so it's enough to see a car that's about to cut you off. It's not enough to see a car speeding up behind you.
You mentioned you're detecting lanes. Any plans incorporating map as well?
I think there's a limit to what you can accomplish with this kind of system where it's purely perception-based. So that's sort of part of our longer-term vision, but we're right now sort of laser-focused on doing everything we can to get this particular product to market and solve some of the problems you guys have brought up. By the way, I was a little nervous coming into this place because I know you guys were going to ask all the tough questions. when you talk to like a you know, a reporter or something, or media, they see this thing driving, or you put them in it, and like 5 minutes later, they're sold. They're like, oh my gosh, it must be safe. Like, it's driven for 30 seconds and hasn't made a mistake. It's like ready to go. So thank you for the good, interesting questions. Yeah. We haven't tested that. That's on our to-do list. So there's a whole, it's interesting, like when you get into the testing realm, thanks for bringing that up, I didn't talk about that yet. We spent, I would say, almost as much time figuring out how to solve these problems technically as we've spent figuring out how to test them. That's probably more than half the battle, because first of all, there aren't any great, you know, like if we're building an airplane, there's this huge checklist of things you have to do and standards you have to meet. There's nothing for self-driving cars or any sort of autonomy at this point, which means we kind of have to, you know, invent the wheel here a little bit. So what we've come up with so far is several types of overlapping testing that we're doing. So the first one is kind of the fun stuff where we come up with sort of these contrived scenarios, like, you know, simulate a motorcycle coming up on the side of the car, or a semi-truck moving over, or a mattress falling off a truck, or this list of about 100 things that we've compiled with some help from NHTSA databases, and try to figure out like what the most common issues are and how we can simulate those and handle the stuff we know about. The next sort of set of testing that we're planning to do is sort of bringing in the third-party experts, you know, those guys I was talking about with decades of experience on this kind of stuff. So those are the companies that basically do automotive crash testing for OEMs, have a lot of experience sort of like ripping apart systems and doing failure modes analysis. And so that'll help us sort of fill in the gaps in sort of our corpus of knowledge in this industry. And then the last kind of testing is the stuff that Google popularizes, which is, you know, like how many miles have we driven, how many hours. We're calling that endurance testing. And that's important both for sort of the traditional mechanical reliability tests of your system, and also to catch some of the things that we didn't think of or the other guys didn't think of, things that happen in the real world but maybe rarely. So we wouldn't catch them unless we have driven, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles or something. So that's where we are right now in terms of what we believe our path to testing will be. And we're going to have some fun sort of like engineering our way through those tests, you know, in a way that a startup can, I guess. Yeah.
Do you want to include a GPS so that as you approach your exit that you program in,
right now we don't have any way to set a destination, mainly because we are trying to come up with a good UI for that. Right now the only UI is a button. So like having a thing where you have to pull out Google Maps and type in one destination and then pull out the Cruise app and type in another is a little hairy. Yeah. So I have a lot of fun stories around that. So our first engineer, her name is Rita, she was programming our first version of the adaptive cruise control. And she likes to drive, like, aggressively. So she's like, Kyle, I have this working. Let's go test it. And so I get in the car and we go for a ride. And then we're like, you know, we're basically hugging the car in front of us. And I'm like, this doesn't seem right. Let's like write this down and figure out a better equation for this. So that's sort of the light bulb moment for me when I realized that people have very particular driving styles. In a robot or a somewhat autonomous system has to emulate those to make people feel comfortable. We also had like sort of a more common scenario in this kind of thing is, you know, if you're trying to do lane keeping, you want to drive perfectly in the center of the line. Or that's what seems like the obvious solution. People, when they're driving down a road, don't usually get in the center of the line. They're often off to one side, and then they like look at the road again, and they're off to the other side. But somehow that feels natural to the passengers, just this like shifting around. When you have a computer driving, if you're trying to go on a perfectly straight line, like the best you can do, you might have like a little bit of oscillation, like around, you're in the center, but maybe you're shifting back and forth a few inches. And typically, if it's a feedback system, that sort of follows this perfect sine wave, which even though it's better and more accurate driving than what the people are doing, it feels weird. It feels like there's a computer driving, and that's something that matters. Like, I think the experience, if you're going to turn on one of these systems, matters more than anything else. It's got to feel safe. It's got to feel like a human, and not like a robot. So, yeah, there's a very interesting area.
I think I saw online that you were planning on delivering to...
Who's talking?
Delivering to customers, I think next year, right?
Yeah.
So what are the legal compliance milestones and also the consumer product liability risk milestones that you need to achieve between now and when you first actually deliver to paying consumers outside of, let's say, a controlled test fleet?
Sure. There's a lot of categories there. I could break that down. But let's see. Let's start with legality. So first of all, California being the great state that it is, we actually have a DMV who's being forward-thinking about this and actually being very thoughtful about what kind of regulations we might need. And so there are some now, and there are more going into effect, I think, in the beginning of next year. But they're targeted more at I think, the kinds of things that Google is doing. Level 2 systems fall more into the category of essentially a cruise control. Like, Mercedes has a system like this out right now, which is Distronic Plus with active lane keeping. Did I get that right? Active lane assist?
Traffic
jam assist, separate feature. So that's currently not a big issue for us. We don't believe we fall into those current regulations, to the best of our understanding of them. And even if we do, those are something that we're comfortable working through. They have good intentions in mind, so I'm not too worried about that. So the regulatory side, at least for California, it's sort of, you know, people are open to that here. The other states, you know, I have trouble keeping track of it, honestly. There's 49 other states, 49 other vehicle codes, and they all define the definition of driver, operator, you know, slightly different. So it's hard to figure out what they actually mean if you're looking at it through the lens of an autonomous system. So we're starting with California. Let's talk about, what was the other one?
Consumer product liability,
right? Okay, so that's sort of a standard thing. I mean, this is a consumer product in a way, so it's similar to any other consumer product liability. That's more of a negotiation between sort of Cruise and our insurance brokers and our insurance providers. So that's something we can take care of. It's a business matter, not really like a policy challenge or anything. And I think the final thing that sort of attaches to that is vehicle warranty and personal auto insurance are two things that some of our potential customers have brought up. I'm not an expert on this right now either, but from what sort of our advisors have told us in the insurance industry, we have not heard from any personal auto insurer that they would explicitly deny coverage for a claim if you had a system like this installed. But again, that's one of those cases where it hasn't happened yet, so we don't really know. And the same kind of goes for vehicle warranty. You know, if you have this installed on your vehicle and, I don't know, your stereo system breaks, they're going to have a hard time showing a correlation there. And it turns out that for warranty claims, you do have to show, so for a car dealer to refuse to repair your vehicle if it's under warranty, they have to be able to show that something you did to it caused that failure. So for example, if you installed our cruise system and suddenly your steering wheel fails or something like that, maybe you could say there is a relation. So that's, again, sort of on us to work with the auto companies and make that more clear.
Okay, we really only have time for two more questions. Go ahead.
What's the sharp?
Let's see if any more
what's
videos.
The sharpest curvature that the system can handle? And it doesn't do lane change, right?
It doesn't do lane change right now, no. Yeah, that's actually limited not by the mechanics of the system, but more by what we've set as our target maximum lateral acceleration, or jerk, rather. And so that's sort of up to us.
US 50 to Tahoe.
Okay, last question.
Are you going to? Oh, I was first.
Okay. you're cheating. You're using your authority here.
Are you going to sell it yourself to customers, or are you going to go through dealers, or what is your plan? I mean, and so that was my first thing, because I was wondering, you know, what if Audi puts, the same capability as, in their vehicles? Are they willing to, how are you going to deal with that?
Well, competition is I don't know what's going to happen in the future. We're starting for our initial deployment of 50 units. We're going to sell those direct and do the installation ourselves. After that, we have a lot of sort of opportunities on the table. We haven't decided on anything yet. Okay, okay, sorry. You were raising your hand like really high.
Right here, this guy right here. Yeah. Last question. Here you go.
Okay, thank you, though. I know you are right now going out of the out to the market right now with this product. I'm just kind of curious to know if you have thought about like the longer term vision. Would this system be some sort of a, you know, would this become a platform? Do you envision that? Would it, you know, interface with, you know, third-party APIs or something? Just your longer-term vision on this.
Yeah, this is just the first step. So we have a lot more sort of planned for down the road, but I don't want to talk about too much of that right now. And so we're sort of focused on this one product, and everything beyond that is still contingent on getting this out. So.
Okay, round of applause for Kyle.